Good morning. It's time to read the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, February 16th, 2020. I'm John Manny, and I'll be with you for the next hour. This broadcast is made possible through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. Here are today's headlines on the front page of the Globe Gazette. If you build it, they will come. Trumpeter Swans continue their comeback. North Iowans bring Festival of Laughs to Clear Lake. And North Iowa County Board Roundup. Weather outlook today. Clouds and sun today. Expect 2 to 4 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity of 85% and poor drying conditions. Cloudy tonight with a bit of sleet and freezing rain late. Chance of precipitation is 55% with average relative humidity of 85%. A couple of snow showers tomorrow. Storm total snowfall 1 to 3 inches. If you build it, they will come. Trumpeter Swans continue their comeback by Melanie Mergen. Picture this. A trumpeter swan soars through the sky, its wings outstretched and backlit by the sun, rendered iridescent. It descends and skids into a shallow pool of wetland waters. The only swan native to Iowa and North America's largest waterfowl, trumpeter swans had occupied this continent by the thousands for centuries. But as European settlers continued their move westward and into Iowa during the 1800s, and in the midst of unregulated market hunting and the extensive loss of wetland habitats, trumpeter swans were virtually wiped off the map in a matter of decades. They were killed for skin, for meat, for feathers. Their dense feathers in particular were used for quills, hats, powder puffs, down jackets, down comforters, and mattresses. David Hoffman, a wildlife research technician with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, says that for settlers looking for their next meals, trumpeter swans would have been an easy choice. You think of our forefathers settling the prairie. Where did they get their food? Did they go to Hy-Vee or Fairway? He said. So they went out with their limited bullets, and with limited powder and bullets, are you going to shoot a 1-pound duck, or are you going to shoot a 28 to 32-pound swan that not only puts food on your table, but money in your pocket if you're going to sell for powder puffs or feathers? This more convenient option, however, wasn't an option with longevity. The last pair of wild nesting trumpeter swans in Iowa occurred in 1883 on the Twin Lakes Wilderness Area, southwest of Belmont in Hancock County. Following that, the birds were completely extirpated from Iowa. They would remain absent for over a century. But it was because of humans' restoration efforts that swans began their comeback, says Hoffman. Minnesota began its restoration efforts in the 1960s, followed by Wisconsin in the 1980s. Iowa started in 1993. In 1993, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources developed a plan to bring trumpeter swans back to Iowa. The plan sought to achieve two objectives. First, to reestablish a self-sustaining migratory population to its former nesting range in Iowa. And secondly, trumpet the cause for wetlands by creating opportunities, like public swan releases, to educate people on both trumpeter swans and the value of healthy wetlands. It's actually the people of Iowa who are responsible for bringing them back to the state, Hoffman said. People donated their time and money. And there's been over $1.75 million of in-kind and soft match money, contributed to help bring trumpeters back. Those funds have been used to cover the costs of feed, vet care, nesting site preparations, equipment, and purchasing swans. In 1998, 115 years after the last known trumpeter swans had occupied Iowa, three wild trumpeter swan cygnets hatched in Dubuque County. In 2000, a second pair nested on a Winnebago County Reservation Board wetland, Rust Tract of Thorpe Park, 8 miles west of Forest City. From that first nest in 1998, trumpeter swans' numbers have been on a slow and steady incline. Iowa had 55 nesting pairs last year, and there are currently 18 active breeding pair sites around the state. Since that first hatch in 1998, 699 known trumpeter swan nests have occurred in Iowa. Here in the five-county area that surrounds Mason City has the highest nesting density in the state, Hoffman said. We also receive swans in from about 10 zoos around the country that donate their cygnets, Hoffman said. So those cygnets that are raised in captivity here in Iowa are from zoos, like Blank Park Zoo, for example. Then those cygnets are the ones that get released out into the wild. Many of the swans in captivity have been injured in the wild and weren't able to return, so they're used for breeding to grow the population. A total of 71 wild, free-flying trumpeter swans have been captured, banded, and released in Iowa since 1997. 20 trumpeter swans were released in Iowa in 2019, making for a total of 1,218 trumpeters released to date. In January 2020, 3,918 trumpeters were tallied in 51 out of 99 Iowa counties during the midwinter waterfowl survey. That's up from 2,470 trumpeters tallied in 40 of 99 counties in January of 2019, and 1,219 in January of 2018. Trumpeter swans depend on wetlands with good water quality. They typically do well in shallow, knee-deep waters, and their diets consist of aquatic plants like tubers. They fancy duckweed, a small plant that floats on the water's surface, as well as arrowhead, also known as duck potatoes, a bitter tuber about the size of a marble. They eat insects, invertebrates, but rarely proteins like fish. They've also witnessed adapting to what resources are most readily available. Some have been seen eating leftover grain, rice, and soybeans across the country. Trumpeter swans can thrive if they have access to enough quality habitat, but in Iowa, the most physically altered state in the nation, that hasn't been easy to come by. 98% of what were once wetlands in Iowa have been erased. That's a really big part of the demise, loss of habitat, Hoffman said. Wetlands are crucial for our water quality and trumpeter swans here in Iowa. Wetlands futures remain in flux. In January, the Trump administration ended federal protection for many of the nation's millions of miles of waterways, including wetlands, leaving many ecosystems nationwide vulnerable to pollution and development projects. Meanwhile, Governor Kim Reynolds has been discussing her plan for the Invest in Iowa Act, which would channel a portion of Iowa sales tax funds to improve water quality, conservation, and outdoor recreation. Any habitat loss is going to be detrimental, not only to the animals, but also to our water quality here in the state, said Hoffman. Humans can stand to benefit from quality wetland habitats as well. They filter pollutants from water, like Mother Nature's kidneys, Hoffman said, and they take in water like a sponge, which helps mitigate flooding. Nearly 75% of released trumpeter swans die before they reach breeding age, and many of these deaths have been the result of human activity. To date, over 400 Iowa trumpeter swan mortalities have occurred, 193 from lead poisoning, 55 in the fall and winter of 2017-2018 alone, 177 from power line collisions, 48 to disease, and 13 to apparent malnutrition. 72 have been poached by violators. Trumpeter swans are still considered endangered in some states, Hoffman says, and their status is protected in Iowa. Shooting one is illegal and could cost you $1,500. In one case, a $17,000 fine was charged to four men in connection with a family group of Iowa swans shot in Texas. Iowa's protected status, as opposed to endangered, allows members of the public to assist with trumpeter swan restoration efforts, says Hoffman. If you build it, they will come actually works for trumpeters as well, Hoffman said, quoting the famous line from the Iowa-based film Field of Dreams. There's been an effort to restore habitat through governmental programs like the Wetlands Reserve Program, and they're really important for our water quality in the state. What's neat to see is the efforts that people have done to restore habitat, said Hoffman, listing a handful of people in the area who have already done so, and that it was amazing to see the tremendous effort people have done to bring these trumpeters back. So what would a healthy trumpeter swan population look like? We're actually developing a management plan to figure that out with a population model, Hoffman said. We're trying to come up with an estimate on sustainable numbers. We'll actually know more in 3 to 4 months when they get that model going. Hoffman said there are a number of ways for the public to get involved. People can participate in habitat conservation programs like the Wetlands Reserve Program, Ducks Unlimited, or Pheasants Forever. In partnership with the Trumpeter Swan Society and filmmaker Steve Harriman, a forthcoming documentary called Return of Trumpeters is set to be released in 2022. Birdwatchers can see a good number of wild swans near Fertile. They start leaving mid to end of February as winter snow and ice begins to melt. So you'll have just a couple weeks to see them. Clear Creek is open at any time, and there's a webcam on site so people can watch from afar too. There are also ways to track trumpeter swans online. One collared swan at https://trumpeterswan.net lify.com/locations.html has been tracked near Fertile recently. Other north central Iowa swans can be tracked at www.nrem.iastate.edu/track-trumpeter. When it comes to the trumpeter swan's future, it seems recovery is just beyond the horizon, so long as they continue to have access to the conditions they need to thrive. That support is critical to supporting and preserving remaining wetlands that are continually under threat, Hoffman said. North Iowans bring Festival of Laughs to Clear Lake by Ashley Stewart. 3 years ago, Jake Peterson and Justin Paulson launched their stand-up comedy show in North Iowa. And since then, the men have performed their two-hour Wolf Dogs comedy feature show at more than 200 bars, breweries, and other venues throughout the Midwest. It's been a slow build, but I think we've really covered some ground in a short amount of time, said Paulson of Mason City. Peterson, a Mason City native who resides in Plymouth, took the plunge as a comedian about 5 years ago at a competition at the Mall of America called Funniest Person with a Day Job. He got 5 minutes. It was then he decided, instead of driving 120 miles for 5 minutes, he'd reach out to local venues to establish a routine and get exposure. Paulson became friends with Peterson about 2 years later and decided to give comedy a try, too. The two did a show together in late 2016 in Plymouth, and a partnership was formed. Together, the men did about 15 stand-up comedy shows their first year, 40 the next year, and more than 80 in 2019. Our goal is to hit 100 this year, Paulson said. Their hope, when they started, which remains the same today, is to make a career out of comedy and create a stand-up comedy scene in North Iowa, so other comedians can do the same. Being from North Iowa, about 2 hours from any comedy club, they've learned that means creating your own opportunities. Peterson and Paulson send thousands of emails a week to bars and venues all over the Midwest attempting to sell their show. They also started a monthly open mic night that takes place the third Thursday of each month at Laredo's in Mason City about 2 years ago that steadily attracted new comedic talent and garnered more attention. There's a handful of pretty funny people that are trying comedy because it's an option now, Peterson said. But for most comedians, the open mic night is their one chance a month to perform. It's for that reason Paulson and Peterson have organized their first North Iowa Comedy Festival on February 22nd at the Surf District Rock and Roll Grill in Clear Lake. The festival, which is already sold out, will feature a full evening of entertainment and showcase the comedic talents of Peterson, Paulson, Jason Clemens, Dylan Meek, Oliver Schmidt, Kelly J. Alliday, David William, Timmy Hayworth, and Matthew Douglas. Peterson said the evening's comedy will be pretty adult-themed, but there is a range from clean to adult humor. That's the cool thing with comedy, especially featuring 10 different comics, is everybody's kind of going to have their own take on things, Paulson said. Where one comic might not be your cup of tea, another one might make you laugh so hard you can't even breathe. That's the cool thing about it. It's all subjective. Josh Alton, an athlete turned comedian originally from the Des Moines area, will headline the event. He's a national touring comedian. We're excited to be able to bring that to North Iowa, Paulson said. If this goes really well, then next year we'll hopefully do bigger and better, and we'll just keep going with it. For more information about Wolf Dogs Comedy and the comedians, visit its Facebook page. North Iowa County Board Roundup by Jared McNett. Each and every week, typically on Tuesdays, supervisor boards in North Iowa meet and run through a bevy of issues that are pertinent to them at the county level. Some of these can be lower-level contract approvals, while others can be large-scale planning for long-term construction projects. And even if one county only has an item or two to consider in a given week, another can have 15 or 20 items. Across the whole North Iowa area, that can add up. To keep that from being too overwhelming and to keep area residents up on what's going on around them, the Globe Gazette is going to have a recurring rundown of notable items county boards in our coverage area considered. It won't be every... It won't be every single item they looked at in a given week, but it will try to hit as much of the important stuff as possible. Butler County. For this week, there were just two items on the agenda for the three-member board in Butler County. The first was a call to order and a review of minutes of the previous meeting, while the second item dealt with a copier contract with Access Systems, an Iowa-based business that's previously done work for the county. In Cerro Gordo County, there were 13 items on the agenda for the board, including pay requests for tile work in Drainage District 33, estimated about $71,000, approval of a sheriff's report of fees earned, about $7,200, and a promotion of February 13th as Iowa Honeybee Day. Iowa has more than 4,500 beekeepers, ranging from hobbyists to full-time commercial beekeepers. The drainage district work in Cerro Gordo County has been ongoing for months. A contractor's pay request, Farm Tile Pro, indicates that the total amount bid plus the approved change orders is $305,185. Two of the bigger ticket items on the Floyd County agenda for the week both dealt with construction-related projects. Review, consideration of action on a contract for a resurfacing project with Mathey Construction Company of Onalaska, Wisconsin, for $2,759,735, and review consideration of action regarding a contract for bridge project with Christensen Brothers of Cherokee, Iowa, for $501,799. Near the end, the board also continued with its fiscal year 2021 budget planning. The re-estimated total ending fund balance for the county for 2018-2019 was $12,212,884. A previous estimate has the 2019-2020 number at $8,489,542. In Franklin County, supervisors approved a road closure in the county with a unanimous vote. The shutdown between Wren Avenue and Hardin Road was done to facilitate needed bridge work. The forthcoming Tuesday meeting of the Hancock County Board of Supervisors will feature a public hearing for Hancock County's proposed property tax levy and maximum property tax dollars for fiscal year 2020-2021, as well as considering the engineer's report on annexation of lands for drainage district purposes. In Kossuth County, the weekly meeting was marked by date settings and public hearings. The five-member panel discussed a max levy public hearing, a public hearing for an internal loan for tax increment, and public hearings for three drainage district improvement projects. Mitchell County's meeting featured eight items, including updates from Mitchell County Sheriff Greg Beaver, Mitchell County Engineer Rich Brum, and County Attorney Mark Walk. One update from the Walk deal with Turtle Creek wind road damage. Previously in 2018, there was a fatal accident during construction of that wind farm, which is located near St. Ansgar. Akin to several other North Iowa counties this week, the Winnebago County supervisors also considered matters related to drainage district improvements. In their case, the drainage districts in question are DD 11 in Newton Township and DD 18 in the Norway Township. The former is in the public hearing stage and is related to wetland mitigation, while the latter is in the bid letting phase. In Worth County, one recurrent issue for county boards is the approval of claims from businesses and locations across their area. This week, the Worth County Board of Supervisors approved $103,888 of claims. In addition to that financial approval, the board also approved changes in hourly and yearly for three employees. The Friday, February 14th agenda for Wright County featured just one item other than the convening of the meeting, and that item was in regard to Drainage District 107, which is in the county's Boone Township. In the opinion page today, Alan Gubert writes, "How rural America can avoid another century of degraded water." Despite the presidential caucus debacle Iowa hosted February 3rd, the too old, too white, and too rural, at least to pundits who drop by every leap year, Hawkeye State still finished its awful week with an act of political courage, rarely seen in U.S. agriculture today. On February 7th, the Des Moines Register published a clear, sharp call to action on the state's increasing degradation of drinking water by pointing the finger directly at Big Ag and its enablers in the Iowa General Assembly. The criticism isn't new. Several Iowa newspapers, especially the Pulitzer Prize-winning Storm Lake Times, regularly point out how Big Ag and the state legislature have worked together to make political buck passing on the state's worsening water quality, Iowa's unofficial sport. The unusual part of the Register's op-ed, however, was its writers, four ag experts with impeccable legal and scientific credentials few could debate separately and no one should take on collectively. More on each later. Their editorial efforts begins with a punch in the face. In 2019, Iowa's streams carried away 1 billion pounds of nitrogen and 50 million pounds of phosphorus. Whoa, 1 billion pounds of wasted nitrogen and 50 million pounds of usable phosphorus? What did that cost Iowa farmers, as well as the state's citizens, parks, and wildlife, whose lives depend on clean water? To date, solutions have been short-sighted and ineffective. In 2013, the Iowa legislature passed its nutrient reduction strategy, a timid approach its backers hoped would pacify public calls to act, but Iowa's water quality has not improved. The reason is as obvious now as then. Iowa's water problems flow from how its farmers operate. When the manure from the state's 25 million hogs and 80 million laying hens is added on top of its fertilizer-intense corn-soybean monoculture, animals are so overpopulated in some areas that manure-borne nutrients far exceed crop needs. Everyone knows this is so. Now it's time to admit the obvious and regroup. All must recognize that the state's livestock industry has grown far beyond our agency's capacity to enforce the weak regulations we have. Worse, these regulations mainly rely on farmer altruism, or self-sacrifice, that will require generations to produce measurable results. And that's just not good enough. We think Iowans deserve better from an industry indemnified by the taxpayer through billions of dollars spent on trade mitigation payments, crop insurance subsidies, and disaster relief. And poor water quality is not the result of callous, poorly informed, or rogue farmers. Rather, it is the predictable result of land use policies, vulnerabilities of the corn-soybean animal confinement scheme, and an economic system tyrannically ruling farmer decisions. What needs to be done, the four experts suggest, are forward-leaning actions most farm groups and state legislatures haven't touched for decades. Now, however, everyone needs to focus on resilient ways that benefit all Iowans, like taxing fertilizer and feed to trim overuse, monitor manure application to stop overapplication, and toughen today's weak regulatory system. These long-needed, well-informed ideas won't go away because the ag experts who offer them are Iowa's most respected ag experts. One is Neil Hamilton, Emeritus Professor of Law at Drake University and a nationally respected ag law expert. Another is Matt Liebman, a professor of agronomy at the H.A. Wallace Chair for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State. Two University of Iowa faculty members round out the four-person team, Sylvia Secchi, specializes in sustainability and public policy, and Chris Jones, a research engineer, writes an authoritative, often provocative blog on Iowa water quality. The four conclude their piece as they began it, with a clear, indisputable fact. Quote, "The challenges represented by our degraded water is enormous. We know of no problems approaching this magnitude that have been solved through individual actions. Iowans deserve more than meaningless platitudes and dogmatic devotion to voluntary approaches. Now is the time to act if we are to avoid another century of degraded water." John Skipper, retired from the Globe-Gazette after 52 years in newspapers, writes, "Political opponents are not the enemy. As we look in the rearview mirror and see the Iowa caucuses fade further and further into the distance, you have to wonder whether we'll ever blaze this trail again. How many car wrecks can you have before the decision is made to avoid that intersection? I think about Jared McNett, the young Globe reporter, who covered the caucus campaign trail for the first time this year and wonder if it will be a one-and-done experience for him. My hope is that it left him with some lasting memories that he will be able to tell his grandchildren someday, as I have been able to do with mine. I have met candidates who were as phony as a $3 bill, candidates who would start to answer a question before You were through asking it because they had an answer well prepared and battle tested. I have met candidates who looked you straight in the eye and others who didn't make eye contact at all. You are a handshake, nothing more, nothing less, and after you, it was on to the next handshake. But I've also learned some life lessons from some of the candidates, even ones who didn't fare too well. Former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson sought the Democratic nomination in 2008 and was a candidate in the Iowa caucuses. Richardson was smart, multilingual, and had successfully negotiated release of American hostages abroad in the Clinton administration. Asked how he was able to deal with people he hated and who hated him, Richardson said, "The key is to find common ground." Washington politicians could use a good dose of that today, don't you think? Along those same lines, former Kansas Senator Bob Dole, who ran for president in 1996, was asked by a North Iowan what was the best way to defeat his enemy, President Clinton. Dole quickly corrected the questioner, saying, "We are political opponents, not enemies." Washington politicians could use a good dose of that today, don't you think? One of my favorite politicians to cover was former President Joe Biden, partly because you never knew which Joe Biden was going to show up. In 2007, campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination, then-Senator Biden took part in a town hall meeting in the Borealis coffee shop downtown, where the KCMR studio is today. Biden spoke to a crowd filling 15 to 20 rows of seats and took questions from the audience. Mason City resident Peter Children was in about the fourth row, and he got into a heated discussion with Biden over America's role in Bosnia, as I recall. Biden became so agitated that, in arguing with Children, he put his hand on the shoulder of audience member Anna Marie Wilson, sitting in the first row, so that he could brace himself and lean toward Children to, in effect, get in his face. They sparred verbally, but it ended with them agreeing to disagree. Later, when the event was over, Children left, and Biden stayed for an hour, chit-chatting informally and amicably with people in the audience, and was charming rather than combative. Several weeks later, Biden was back, this time speaking to a crowd at the Masonic Temple. After his speech, he agreed to an interview, and the two of us sat in easy chairs and had an easygoing chat. Biden told of how when he first came to the Senate, as its youngest member, he was brash and cocky and acted as if he questioned the intelligence of veteran senators who didn't see things his way. Mike Mansfield of Montana was the Senate Majority Leader. Biden said one day Mansfield called him into his office to have a little talk with him. The Majority Leader pointed toward the Senate floor and told Biden, "Everyone who is here because people in their state found some value in them. That's what you need to do." Washington politicians could use a good dose of that today, don't you think? Our first letter to the editor is by Christy Parks of Northwood, and it's entitled, "Apology Warranted for Sports Headline." "I am very disgusted by your humiliating comment about the Northwood Kensett girls basketball team. You should be ashamed of yourself for printing such disrespect for these young ladies. They practice hard every day and go onto that court and play their hearts out. All we ask as parents and coaches that they do their best. Then to have your department print such derogatory remarks about a team that you have no knowledge of. Extremely disappointed in your choice of words. I feel an apology should be made to this team and their coaches." Josh Burns of Osage writes, "NIAC has strong economic impact on our communities. As the former NIAC Industrial Division Chair, I know firsthand the positive economic impact North Iowa Area Community College has on the North Iowa region each year. NIAC has been an integral part of the community since it opened in 1918. NIAC programs train students to gain fulfilling employment in our area, while keeping convenience and flexibility in mind. For these reasons, one out of six residents in North Iowa was served by NIAC in 2019. NIAC serves as a catalyst to promote new job creation in North Iowa and works collaboratively with local employers to meet their customized training needs. NIAC educates future graduates for professional work and provides assistance to residents who want to earn more. In fact, experts estimate that there is a 10.4% return on every dollar invested in NIAC. Fully 82% of NIAC graduates live, work, and pay taxes in North Iowa. These students choose from one of 45 academic programs, graduate and enter the workforce, or enroll in a four-year college in our area to continue their education. Please join me in casting a yes vote for NIAC's bond levy on March 3rd or by absentee ballot prior to the election day. The bond levy is based on a homeowner's assessed property tax valuation and is a nominal contribution when you consider the great benefit our community college provides for Mitchell County. A homeowner with property assessed at $100,000 will pay approximately 85 cents per month, or $10.17 per year, toward NIAC's fund to replace, repair, and upgrade college buildings and technology. NIAC turned 100 years old this year, and this bond levy, the first of its kind in its history, will ensure the future for thousands of North Iowa residents who are served by NIAC every year. Rob Gertis of Garner writes, seeking support for Hancock County Sheriff. With the upcoming retirement of Sheriff Scott Dodd at the end of the year, it is with great excitement that I am announcing my candidacy for the position of Sheriff of Hancock County in the upcoming November 2020 election. I would be proud to uphold the great tradition of the Hancock County Sheriff's Office. I believe the citizens in Hancock County deserve the best, and the Board of Supervisors, current department heads, and employees do a wonderful job. I was born and raised in Hancock County. My father was a Hancock County Deputy Sheriff from 1976 to 1999 and the Hancock County Sheriff from 1999 to 2005. I enlisted in the Iowa Army National Guard in May of 1991. I served 6 years as a combat medic and cannon crew member. I was honorably discharged from Iowa National Guard. In May of 1997, I graduated from North Iowa Area Community College with a criminal justice degree. I also started my first law enforcement job in May of 1997 when I was hired by Worth County as a deputy sheriff. In July of 2000, I was hired by Winnebago County as a deputy sheriff. In July of 2005, I was hired by Hancock County as a deputy sheriff. This May will mark 23 years as a deputy sheriff. In 2008, I was selected to join a North Central Iowa Narcotics Task Force Special Operations Group, SOG, where I have served as an assistant team leader for the last 7 years. The SOG team serves a 9-county area in North Central Iowa by serving high-risk arrest search warrants along with dignitary protection. I have been a member of the American Legion for the last 18 years. I have also been volunteering my time with Families of the Fallen. Thank you for your support in November. Today we have obituaries for William Bill Elliott, Leroy F. Kassman, Naomi Bianfang, Anna L. Marsh, David Garger, Ricky Ricardo Jackson, Wilma A. Kirchhoffer, Aaron J. Burrell, Betty J. Brown, Kent A. Ewing, Gary J. Frericks, Gertrude M. Marsh. William W. Bill Elliott, 77, of Mason City, passed away on Tuesday, February 11th at Mercy One, North Iowa, Mason City, with his children by his side. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. on Monday, February 17th, at the First Baptist Church in Mason City, with Reverend Jim Bringman officiating. Burial will follow in Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery. Visitation with public viewing will be held Sunday afternoon, February 16th, from 2 to 4 p.m. at Hogan Brummermore Colonial Chapel in Mason City, and will resume 1 hour prior to service at the church on Monday. In lieu of customary remembrances, memorials may be left in Bill's name to the Lime Creek Nature Center or the Humane Society of North Iowa. The son of Olaf and Esther Boyd Elliott, William Wayne Elliott, was born on August 22, 1942, in Bristow. Bill attended the Mason City High School, where he enjoyed playing on the tennis team. Following his graduation, Bill enlisted in the United States Army, where he faithfully served his country before his honorable discharge. Upon his return to Mason City, Bill enrolled at NIAC before beginning his career with the United States Postal Service as a mail clerk, a position he would hold for over 35 years until his retirement. On September 19, 1965, Bill was united in marriage to Paulette Polly Hall in Mason City. Together, they would be blessed with 2 children. In his free time, Bill enjoyed reading, bowling, and fishing with his son, Steve. He was proud of his Mason City roots and was always cheering on the Mason City Mohawks and NIAC Trojans. He also enjoyed the Iowa Hawkeyes, Minnesota Twins, and Vikings. Bill was a longtime member of the First Baptist Church in Mason City. Hogan Brummermore Colonial Chapels is in charge of arrangements. Leroy Francis Kassman, 100, of Hampton, passed away on Friday, February 14th at the Rehabilitation Center of Hampton. He was born on October 14th, 1919 in Breckenridge, Minnesota, to Joanne Henry and Elizabeth Lurson Cassman. Leroy attended country schools in Breckenridge, Minnesota. He was united in marriage to Lucille Eisentrager on April 22, 1942 in Airedale. Leroy served his country in the United States Navy during World War II in the Pacific aboard the USS Gilbert Islands. Leroy was a contractor. He built or remodeled numerous houses in the area, as well as public buildings, churches, and schools within a 50-mile radius of Hampton. Leroy was a member of First Congregational United Church of Christ in Hampton. He enjoyed fishing, camping, woodworking, dancing, playing cards, and traveling. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, February 18th at First Congregational United Church of Christ in Hampton. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, February 17th at Sites of Mavogo Funeral Home in Hampton. Burial will take place in Dumont Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be sent in memory of Leroy to the First Congregational United Church of Christ in Hampton or to the Hampton Senior Center. Naomi Bienfang, 55, of Charles City, passed away February 9th at the Floyd County Memorial Center, Medical Center, from a combination of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, frontal temporal dementia, and complications of PTSD. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, February 22nd, at Hauser Weishar Funeral Home in Charles City. There will be no graveside service. A luncheon at the Columbus Circle in Charles City will follow the service. A gathering of family and friends will begin at 10 a.m. until the start of the service at Hauser Weishar Funeral Home on Saturday. Naomi was born May 14, 1964, in Waterloo to Harold and Aris Wettengel Bienfang. She was a 1982 graduate of of Jessup High School, and 1987 graduate of Northwest Missouri State, where she received her Bachelor of Arts degree in music education. She later earned her Master of Science degree in the Environmental Sciences from University of Northern Iowa. After her undergraduate studies, Naomi enlisted in the United States Air Force, where she served as a clarinetist with the Strategic Air Command Band in Offutt Air Base in Omaha. She was also stationed in Germany for 3 years with the United States Air Force Band in Europe. Following her discharge from active duty, Naomi enlisted with the 185th Iowa Air Guard in Sioux City, where she served as a public health technician. She was deployed twice as guardsman to Iraq and Kuwait as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. She was discharged from the Guard in 2011 as a master sergeant after 21 years of service to her country. Outside of her military service, Naomi worked in the public health field in Kansas and Iowa. In 2010, she and her partner opened Rothman Band Instrument Service, first in Mason City and then in Charles City in 2015. Naomi worked as a repair technician, a private music instructor, and an instrumentalist. She was a very active player in North Iowa as a member of the Mason City Band, Nyack Band and Orchestra, Cedar River Summer Stock Theater, and the Iowa Military Veterans Band, as well as her local clarinet choir, the UNI Clarinet Choir, and various other performing groups in northern Iowa. She was also a member of several church choirs throughout the years and a performer with the Waterloo Community Playhouse. Naomi was a warrior with a poet's heart and was greatly devoted to her music students throughout the years. Her memory will live on in their music. Memorials may be directed in her name to the Floyd County Medical Center and the Floyd County Veterans Affairs Office. Hauser Weishar Funeral Home in Charles City is in charge of local arrangements. Anna L. Marsh, 99, died Saturday, February 15th at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice in Mason City. Funeral arrangements are pending with Hogan Bremermore Colonial Chapels in Mason City. David Allen Garter, 71, of St. Ansgar, died unexpectedly Sunday, February 9th at Mitchell County Regional Health Center in Osage. Family services will be held at a later date within Ermont in Pleasant Hill Cemetery in Mona. Champion Bookite Funeral Home in Osage is in charge of arrangements. Ricky Ricardo L. Jackson, 59, died Monday, February 10th at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. A celebration of life will be at 11 a.m. on May 23rd at Mulligan's Barn Grill, 2791 4th Street Southeast, Mason City. Hogan Bremermore Colonial Chapels is in charge of arrangements. Dr. Wilma Ardeen Leitner Kirchhofer met her transition on February 10th. She joins her beloved husband, parents, Tressie Loretta Traylor Leitner and William Bernard Leitner, brother Louis Hubert Scherfile Jr., as well as a host of loved ones. Wilma was involved in many organizations in Atlanta and around the world, including being a Golden Life member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, Atlanta Suburban Alumni Chapter. She served as a board member of the 62nd and the 65th Regiment Legacy Foundation. Wilma was also the founder of Youth Leadership for Global Health and was an active member of the Friendship Force of Greater Atlanta. The Omega Service of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, will begin at 9 a.m. on Saturday, February 22nd. The memorial service and celebration of life will follow at 10 a.m. with repast immediately after in the Fellowship Hall. New Life Presbyterian Church is at 6600 Old National Highway, College Park, Georgia, 30349. In lieu of flowers, those wishing to honor Wilma Ardeen may donate to the Bird Kirchhofer Scholarship Fund, the 62nd and 65th Regiment Legacy Foundation, Incorporated, P.O. Box 1376, Jefferson City, Missouri, 65102, or online, www.62-65rlf.com. Aaron John Birrell, B-I-E-R-L, 33, of Norris Springs, died February 5th at home. A celebration of life will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, March 7th, at Sheckler Colonial Chapel in Norris Springs. Betty J. Brown, 87, of Dumont, died Friday, February 14th, at Franklin County View Nursing Facility in Hampton. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, February 20th, at New Hope United Methodist Parish in Airedale. Visitation is from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, February 19th, at Sitzema Vogel Funeral Home in Dumont. Burial in Dumont Cemetery. Kent A. Ewing, 62, of Forest City, died Friday, February 14th. Good Samaritan Society in Forest City. Services will be held at a later date. Gary J. Frerichs, F-R-E-R-I-C-H-S, 86, of Clear Lake, died Saturday, February 15th at Good Shepherd Health Center in Mason City. Arrangements are pending with Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake. Funeral service for Gertrude M. Marsh, 104, of Green, will be at 2 p.m. Tuesday, February 18th at United Methodist Church in Green, with Pastor Joan Thomas officiating. Burial in Rose Hill Cemetery in Green. Visitation is noon to 2 p.m. Tuesday at the church. Gertrude died Friday, February 14th at Valley View Care Center in Green. Memorials to the family at P.O. Box 219 Green, 50636. Rhett's Funeral Home in Green is in charge of arrangements. Dennis Carney today writes, Outdoor Rec Trust Fund money will increase land stewardship resources. Dennis Carney is a Cerro Gordo Soil and Water District Commissioner. The local office can be found at 1415 South Monroe, Mason City. Online, cerrogordoswcd.org. For those of us that work in or support private lands conservation work, the news from Iowa's Capitol a couple weeks ago was very encouraging. After 10 years of refusing to fund the Iowa Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund Amendment, passed in 2010 with over 65% Iowa voter approval, the governor's office has decided to support the legislation with funding. Also known as Iowa Water and Land Legacy, this amendment fund will, unless changed before implementation, supply a much-needed new funding source to protect the state's streams, lakes, rivers as an investment in clean water. For fiscal year 2019, Iowa's 100 soil and water conservation districts operated on about $25 million. These funds, administered by the Division of Soil Conservation in Iowa's Department of Agriculture, supply cost-share dollars to agricultural landowners who want to protect their land from erosion. This new funding could supply an additional $150 million to the state and districts to expand programs and staff to assist and educate more landowners. By protecting our most valuable resource, our soil, everyone in the state benefits. These expenditures may be used to enhance soil health, thus improving water quality for recreation and for consumption. The more conservation practices and structures on the ground, the longer communities can supply safe drinking water without expensive new facilities. While landowners reduce their soil loss and degradation, these efforts are truly about the quality of life, both urban and rural. The cost-share dollars supplied to the soil and water conservation districts are also used to subsidize the adoption of new soil health practices, such as no-till and cover crops. A couple of years as a small incentive might entice producers to try a new practice that they just might discover is profitable, even without the subsidy. As always, old habits are hard to break, and excessive, ill-timed tillage seems to be the hardest thing for many farmers to quit. Over the past year, The Natural Resource Conservation Service in Iowa has greatly increased its staffing in offices across the state. These experts will be key to assisting state and local district office experts administer a new push for land and water stewardship that is being demanded by the general public. The interest in the implementation of the IWLL funding is another indication that agriculture needs to quickly transition to more sustainable methods of land stewardship. If you have an opportunity to visit with your state legislator, please express your support for this increase in funding for soil and water conservation. If you have questions on programs available to help you protect your soil and water resources, contact your local soil and water conservation district. In Cerro Gordo County, call 641-424-4452 or check our website at cerrogordoswcd.org. In celebrations, Elroy Schultz and Ali Kunzman Schultz celebrated 75 years of marriage on February 13th with dinner at the Park Inn. Cards and best wishes may be sent to 1627 9th Street Southwest, Mason City. Ken Rodemeyer and Bernie Prather Rodemeyer of Mason City were married February 20th, 1955 in Hampton. They will be celebrating their 65th wedding anniversary. Cards and wishes may be sent to them at 1431 North Rhode Island Avenue, Mason City, 50401. Betty Lily Engbritson of Sheffield will be celebrating her 100th birthday on February 22nd. Betty graduated from Mason City High School in 1937 and has lived in North Central Iowa her entire life. She's the proud mother of six children. Cards and wishes may be sent to her at 321 Maple Street, Sheffield, 50475. And Edna Drewis, will be celebrating her 100th birthday with family. She was born on February 17, 1920, on a farm near Frederica, Iowa. She married her husband, Irwin, in 1946, and he passed away in 1995. She's lived in Osage the last 10 years and is currently residing at Faith Lutheran Home. Cards and wishes may be sent to her at 914 Davidson Drive, Osage, 50461. She would love to hear from you. Michelle Sprott Murray, a writer who lives in Mason City, writes today, taking the old brain out for a workout. Oh, the joys of aging. If it isn't one thing, it's another. Our 18-year-old son recently informed us that all old people talk about is what they ate and what hurts on them. I'd say that's a fairly accurate observation. I don't know about you, but I sure find things happening to my mind and body with each passing decade. One of the more disturbing things is that I now go into one room on a mission, and once I get there, I forget the reason for my journey. It's not only that, but I'm at a loss for words sometimes. This even happens to a writer whose tools consist of words. It's in the cold place where you put food, I found myself saying when I couldn't think of that very difficult word, refrigerator. This loss for words is multiplied exponentially when I'm faced with remembering someone's name. Oh, it could be just the right end name for one of my two sons, Nick and Noah, and sometimes even that boggles my mind. Imagine if we'd had a third child. That poor soul would have never known his or her real name. You start with the oldest and then move down, right? No wonder younger siblings always have to patiently wait until their parents finally get to their name. Recently, my old brain has gotten quite a workout. I'm playing the lead role in the Neil Simon show, The Gingerbread Lady, at our community theater. Believe me, I struggled with the thought of even auditioning as I saw the plethora of lines this character has. And then one day, out of the blue, I happened to be watching Live with Kelly and Ryan, where Kelly Ripa was interviewing Laura Linney, one of my favorite actresses, and it was like a sign from God to go to that audition and try for that part. Linney talked about being in a one-woman show adapted from one of my favorite books, My Name is Lucy Barton, by Elizabeth Strout. She shared what it was like to have all the lines in the show. It hit me that she is my age, and if she could learn an entire show, then what was stopping me? Another interview with Linney brought a new favorite quote to me. She said that when she was asked to be in this one-woman show, the only reason I would say no is pure cowardice. So, here I am in production week, jumping into something that really scared me, and now doing it for all the world to see. Out of a 76-page script, I only have 5 pages where I don't have lines. A fellow actor asked me if I counted my lines like he always does when he's in a show. I told him no, because that would scare me. How does a writer who forgets words and a mom who forgets names learn the plethora of lines for such a difficult role? Prayer, rehearsal, and solo preparation of about 2 to 3 hours daily before I go to dress rehearsal, and certainly before shows. I sure hope audiences appreciate the time and energy I've put into being Eva Mira in this show. My fellow actors on stage are absolutely amazing, and they have put up with my process of becoming Evie. I told my older son the other day that I am mainly doing this so that I can prove to myself that I can. I'm jumping out of my comfort zone and facing a huge challenge. Audience applause will be the icing on the cake. If there's any of that cake left over, well, I'll just store it in the cold place where you put food. Tickets for The Gingerbread Lady may be bought online at mccommunitytheater.com or by calling the MCCT box office at 641-424-6424. Shows run February 13th to 16th and 20th to 23rd. J.W. Sales writes, A Mammoth Leap. Last year, 2019, reminded us of many things that have reached milestone achievements. Collapse of the Berlin Wall, 30. Birthday of my niece, 30. First moon landing, 50. Woodstock Festival, 50. The Amazing Mets, 50. Nintendo Game Boy, 30. Sony Walkman, 40. Three Mile Island nuclear accident, 40. Sesame Street, 50. Beatles' last public performance, 50. WW2 D-Day landings, 75. Treaty ending World War I, 100. And first African slaves kidnapped and forced to America, 400. To summarize just a few, 2019 was a year of importance for us to remember our history. But unless I missed it, one event that molded the last third of the 20th century seemed to slip by without much fanfare equal to its significance. In 1969, the internet became a reality. Not the version so essential to our lives today, but the precursor created so government agencies and researchers could share ongoing scientific study and communicate by a dinosaur-like email system. By 1976, post-Army tour of duty, I had been hired by the U.S. Treasury Department. As one of the young guys, 44 years ago, in the trenches, I was deemed to be trainable in the recently adapted computer system called ARPANET, Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, or as known today, the Internet. The ARPANET was funded by on-budget and off-budget dollars coming from you and DARPA. Yes, that DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, infamous, for providing, in addition to the internet, the American taxpaying public with GPS global positioning satellites, high-resolution satellite imagery, multi-level security access for networks, the cloud, shared storage, Alexa, Google's assistant, Siri, and even IBM's Watson computer. But DARPA has also spent our dollars on DARPA, 1, DARPA burned through tens of millions trying to identify and recruit telepaths who could conduct remote viewing and thus perform espionage against the Soviets by telepathy. The verdict is still out on how much additional money was spent evaluating the efficacy of tinfoil hats as a defense tool for thwarting Soviet telepathic countermeasures. And my all-time favorite. JC's meeting to feature local, state, and national member. In a little more than a week's time, residents of both Mason City and Clear Lake will be able to chat about issues facing the area in an event that's local in focus, but will be somewhat regional and national in attendance. On Friday, February 21st, the Mason City JCs, with the help of the state-level JCs chapter and the national JCs group, will hold a roundtable discussion event at the Best Western Holiday Lodge in Clear Lake to identify local challenges and community solutions to those challenges. A release for the Love the Town meeting makes clear that members of the public are free to attend the event, which is set to start at 5 p.m. and should last about 2 hours. The local Mason City chapter holds its regular meetings the fourth Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. at Stampede's Bar and Grill in Mason City. The group's primary focus at all levels is aimed at developing future leadership through service and volunteerism, while also providing social and community opportunities. Retirement open house plan for Bill Schickel on February 28. The community is invited to a retirement open house for Bill Schickel from 2 to 4 p.m. February 28th at KCMR Radio, 316 North Federal Avenue in Mason City. Schickel is leaving as KCMR Radio General Manager after serving in the position for 23 years. He will continue serving as mayor. The open house will also be a chance to meet new KCMR Radio General Manager, Amy Caduce. Clear Lake Classical to hold open house. Clear Lake Classical is having an informational open house at 6 p.m. on February 20th. There will be a brief presentation by students followed by a discussion with the headmaster. For more information or to RSVP, visit www.clearlakeclassical.org/events. Child care is provided for those who RSVP. Clear Lake's Ag program is booming. With 78 students, new program is exceeding expectations. By Grace Zablatsky. The new Agriculture and FFA program at Clear Lake High School is only halfway through its first year and already has seen some huge growth. There are now 78 students in the program in the second semester, a growth from the first semester's 50 members, and each student in the FFA program has to take an agriculture class as well, according to agriculture teacher and FFA advisor Alyssa Russ. Though the rapid growth can be a challenge, Russ said it keeps the program exciting, and having her students show energy and interest in agriculture and FFA by filling the classrooms and FFA meetings keeps her going. I always remind myself that the opportunities I am helping provide these students are ones they didn't have before the program was started, so that helps keep me grounded, she said. Agriculture is a relevant and unique area for students to learn more about, with a lot of diversity within the industry, so there's always something to interest students, Russ said. When students can see the importance and the why behind what they're learning, it keeps them engaged and excited about the content, she said. Russ said she will offer more agriculture classes in high school next year, adding a plant science and animal science class in addition to her agricultural leadership and introduction to agriculture, food, and natural resources class. I'm also hoping to get our middle schoolers more involved in FFA, she said. Working with students completely new to the agricultural world has been one of the biggest challenges, Russ said, especially since she has been surrounded by agriculture and FFA since I was born. Trying to teach something that is like second nature to me can be difficult, but it's incredibly rewarding for them to learn about FFA and show excitement for what they're doing, she said. Sophomore Macy Wilkie, the Clear Lake FFA chapter sentinel, said she joined in August 2019 because she grew up on a small hobby farm where she got the feel of what agriculture was and she loved that aspect of it. The whole world is like agriculture. What you eat, it has to do with ag, it even And even just leadership involves ag too, Wilkie said. That brings us to the end of the reading in the Mason City Globe Gazette for February 16th, 2020. Your reader today has been John Manning. This broadcast has come to you through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of IRIS or KCMR. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for today's reading in the Des Moines Register. You're listening to IRIS, your 24-hour radio reading service. Have a great day.